from KQED.
This is Michael Krasny. Today, in this special July 4th edition of Forum and Happy Independence Day, we visit our archives. In the first half hour, we'll listen back on our recent interview with Stanford psychologist Lyra Boroditsky, who, in a radical departure from modern linguistic theory, claims language greatly influences our thoughts and perceptions. We talked to her as part of our first-person series profiling innovative thinkers in the Bay Area. And in the second half, musician and naturalist Bernie Krause. In his new book, The Great Animal Orchestra, he explores how animals use sound to survive in their habitats and examines the contributions of natural rhythms to human musical expression. Forum is next, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the Forum program. There are some 7,000 languages in the world, and it seems to our guests that each is a universe unto itself. Does language shape thought? Well, it seems from the research conducted by Stanford professor Lyra Boroditsky, that it does. A cognitive scientist who is an assistant professor of psychology, neuroscience, and symbolic systems at Stanford, Lyra Boroditsky was named Utney Reader's Visionary in 2011, and she joins us as part of our ongoing series. It's a first-person series that features the leaders, innovators, and other compelling characters that make the Bay Area unique. And good to have you here. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, let's begin by talking about what I would call heterodoxy. I don't want to sound too academic here, but boy, you've taken on Chomsky, really. And I mean, in a sense, you've taken him on because he always felt that language really is shared in terms of deep thought by all languages, universal, and doesn't necessarily separate. And here you are saying something quite different than that. Language shapes thought. It shapes more than that. It shapes the way we focus, the way we remember. So tell us how you began to see that configuration as opposed to what has been almost standard boilerplate for years.
I certainly didn't set out trying to take on Chomsky. That would be a foolish thing to do under the best of circumstances.
We should mention he's the MIT linguist as well as the political commentator, yes.
I started out as a naive psychologist, and my question was simply, does experience shape the way we think? And in psychology, the answer to that is almost always yes, that the things that you do, the things you practice, change the way you think, make you better at doing certain things, make you worse at doing other things. And to me, naively, language didn't seem any different from that. Different languages encourage different practices, and I thought, therefore, it should be the case that depending on which language you speak, you should become more practiced at making certain cognitive distinctions, more practiced at using different cognitive tools. So I didn't come out at this question from a very confrontational point of view, but of course it turns out to be a very controversial question.
In fact, I think you've said publicly that had you known it was so controversial, you might not have waded in these waters after all.
Yes, I think it was definitely a foolhardy thing to do.
Well, but you've gone into new territory, mm-hmm. and it's exciting territory. And let's talk about this territory. And territorially, I'm thinking about, for example, the difference between how one describes a bridge in French and German. Mm-hmm. This is a good bridge to get into your research because the German uses a feminine word, the French use a masculine word, and consequently you've noted that the French talk about the heft and power. One would associate this more on the surface with mm-hmm. Germans, but when they use a word like bridge and the French talk about, the Germans talk more about beauty. Mm-hmm. So that kind of distinction can be sort of fanned out into so many ways that language is used.
Yeah, it's true. Languages, of course, make many distinctions beyond just grammatical gender, though grammatical gender is a really fun example to explore because it seems so arbitrary. Why should a bridge or a chair be masculine or feminine?
Or why should something be a fatherland or a motherland? I remember that, you know.
The research on grammatical gender actually started with an observation made by Roman Jakobson, who's a famous Russian linguist. And he noticed that when Russians personify different days of the week, they act like people of different genders. So when they're acting like Monday, they'll act like a man. but when they're acting like Wednesday, they'll act like a woman. And this has to do with the grammatical genders in Russian. Monday is grammatically masculine and Wednesday is grammatically feminine. And so he was the first to propose that the grammatical genders in language actually shape how we perceive these abstract entities or inanimate objects.
So it's a kind of different private world that lives in each of us based on the language we speak. That's really your hypothesis. What happens to people, for example, who are multiple speakers of different languages who grow up multilingual?
Then you have multiple worlds living inside you. You know, Charlemagne said that to have a second language is to have a second soul. That's obviously a very strong statement about what another language brings to you. But in research, it definitely looks like speakers of people who speak multiple languages take multiple perspectives. And in fact, those perspectives are often active at the same time, even when you're not speaking both languages at the same time.
I always like the old saw that people who speak three languages are trilingual, two are bilingual, and one are American. You also, this research of yours took you pretty far afield. You went and studied Aborigines in Australia, and let's talk about that because that's also pretty interesting stuff. Where when we give somebody directions, we say go left, go right, whatever, and this particular tribe talks about, like, go southeast, go northwest.
Yeah. That's right. There are, in fact, quite a lot of languages around the world that don't rely on words like left and right and instead put everything in some kind of cardinal or absolute directions. Work by linguistic anthropologists like Steve Levinson and John Hovland first really described these languages and showed that people who speak languages like this are incredibly good at staying oriented. And the reason that is, if your language requires you to be able to say, there's an ant on your northwest leg, or pass the cup to the north-northeast a little bit, or in the language that I got a chance to study, the Kuuk-Thaayorre language, the way you say hello, in English we say, how are you? Fine. In Kuuk-Thaayorre you say, which way are you going? And the answer should be something like, north-northwest in the far distance. How about you? So imagine as you're walking around, every person you say hi to, you have to report your heading direction. That's a really strong social invitation to stay oriented, right? If you can't enter into the most basic social interaction without being oriented, you would immediately learn how to orient yourself.
A lot of your work has to do with agency. You say, for example, you knock over a cup, you say you broke the cup, but in Spanish, it's the cup broke itself.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, if you literally translate it, yeah?
Yeah, so languages differ in the extent to which they distinguish between accidents and intentional events. And English is a little bit strange in that we can talk about accidental events and intentional events using basically the same descriptions. So whether I meant to break the cup or whether it was an accident, it's normal to say, I broke the cup. But in other languages, you have to talk about accidents a different way. So you can't in some languages say something like, I broke my arm, unless you're crazy and you went out looking to break your arm and then so you succeeded. If it was an accident, as most arm breakings we imagine are, then you would use a different form, like my arm got broken or my arm broke.
So how does that make us different? I mean, psychologically or mentally or, you know, what can you really quantify here? Because a lot of this gets into some curious empirical types of ways of looking at things, but where do you collate the data and go with it?
With my student Caitlin Fossey, we've started looking at what people pay attention to in events, depending on how they would describe them. So if you wouldn't describe the person who might be an agent of an event, if you don't say, she broke the cup, but instead you say, the cup broke, do you maybe not remember who did it as well? Or do you maybe not blame the person as much? So we've been doing studies looking at how much people blame, how much they want to punish the people involved, and whether they even remember who was involved. And we find that all of these things differ depending on how you would describe the event. So there are differences in really important consequences like eyewitness memory, blame, punishment, financial liability, the things that we care about in our culture.
Well, and you get into so many, you think about geopolitical discussions that are translated. You think about things that go on in courtrooms, international tribunals that are translated. I mean, this just fans out into so many areas. Again, we're talking to Lyra Boroditsky, who is assistant professor of psychology at Stanford, and it's part of our first-person series. What about time? I mean, there are temporal differences in language mm-hmm. with respect to past, present, and future mm-hmm. that really need to be understood in this larger context of psychology, don't they?
Yeah, time is a fascinating domain. I've spent actually most of my time studying time. The word time is the most frequent noun in English, so we seem to be obsessed with it in our language. And it turns out that time is incredibly flexible, both across languages and cultures and across people's minds. The way we conceive of time can really shift depending on context. Some languages will invite their speakers to think of the future as being ahead. So in English, for example, the future is ahead of us and the past is behind us. But in other languages, it's exactly the reverse. So the Aymara, this is work by Rafael Nunez and Yves Switzer, the Aymara reverse the direction of time completely. The future is behind them, and the past is in front of them. So when they're talking about the past and the future, they gesture accordingly. When they're talking about the past, they gesture ahead of themselves.
But we often, this makes me think about it, English is spoken in so many different cultures and so many different places, in Canada, Australia, you know, New Zealand, and so forth, that you have to wonder about how much culture really shapes thinking, mm-hmm. too. I mean, to a great degree, it must work in tandem and in some ways in opposition with what you're talking about, which is language.
Absolutely. I think of language as one part of culture, so I don't think of it as a separate, as something that's separate from culture. They have a subset-superset relationship. So there's language, that's one part of culture, and then there's all the other stuff that exists outside of language that is the rest of culture. And we definitely see influences going both ways, that extra-linguistic features influence how we talk. Of course, languages are human-invented tools. We create languages to suit our needs. That's why we have so many, because people have different needs around the world. But at the same time, the things that we build into languages tend to stick around and tend to influence many, many generations after. So take a feature like grammatical gender, where we started. No modern French speakers chose to have grammatical gender in their language. They were born into a culture that uses grammatical gender, and you have no choice but to use grammatical gender if you speak a language like that. You just have to learn it. Second language speakers attest to how difficult it is to to learn a language with grammatical gender. But now you're influenced by it. Your thinking, whenever you look at something that can be named by a noun, is influenced by this quirk of grammar that got built in a long, long time ago.
I'm also thinking about just how a lot of your work is revelatory, not only about grammar idiosyncrasies, but about language and its connotative and denotative power, and how it evokes... For example, there you were, I think, writing about the Super Bowl back mm-hmm. in 2004 when they had the so-called wardrobe malfunction.
That's right. But
the linguistic sense of that is, did Justin Timberlake rip the costume, or was the costume ripped? And mm-hmm. you have a whole different kind of series of psychological responses to that language. Or another example I found in your work is you talk about a city crime wave as being viewed as... a wave of crime or a beast of crime, or, I mean, just these choices of words can evoke a whole psychology.
Yeah, we've done work looking at how language can evoke knowledge structures, and often even a single word, if it's the right word, can evoke a whole knowledge structure. So if you say crime is a beast attacking a city, that makes you think about what it means to contain a beast and what you would do in the case that there was an actual beast.
Not common usage, though, for crime, but it has been used, I guess.
It has been used, and the contrast for us was crime as a virus attacking a city, which is very common. And in fact, now people are designing crime intervention programs specifically based on epidemiological ideas. How do you stop the spread of crime in the same way that you stop the spread of disease? And so what we study is how using even a single word metaphor like that can influence the kinds of solutions people are likely to come up with, the kinds of knowledge structures they build up. And this is, of course, something that politicians know really well, right? Whenever politicians talk about social issues, the discussion is rife with metaphors, and those metaphors all steer you into thinking in a particular way about the social issue.
Talking with Lyra Boroditsky, who was named visionary last year by Utney Reader and is assistant professor of psychology at Stanford, there's work that you did with having people use pins to prick balloons. Talk about that. kind of an unusual experiment, but it has to do with agency again, doesn't it?
That's right. We show people videos of accidental or intentional events. So someone either pricks the balloon intentionally to pop it or accidentally pops the balloon. And we asked speakers of Spanish and English and Japanese to describe these events. We found some really interesting differences in how people describe events. So English speakers would almost always use an agentive expression like "he popped the balloon," where Spanish speakers might say "the balloon popped." we get some wonderful other non-agentive language in Spanish. My favorite example we have a case where someone is writing with a pencil and the pencil breaks as the person is writing. And the Spanish description was, out of nowhere, a pencil split itself in two. This is the sort of thing that sounds really evasive to English speakers. That's not a normal way of speaking in English. But in Spanish and lots of other languages, that is normal. It would sound too punitive to talk about an accident by saying he broke the pencil. Clearly, it wasn't somebody's fault or intent.
Lara Boroditsky here with us in studio and was known, by the way, in high school as a Red Fury because of her intensity of debating. And red, as many of you know, in Russian is Krasny. You've done some studies about the shades of blue in Russian, mm-hmm. and how they contrast to English. And again, talk about that and what it means, really, to see these differences in color.
Mm-hmm. Languages differ a whole lot in how they divide up the world of color. Some languages have only a couple of words for colors. Some languages make lots of distinctions. And languages also differ in where they put boundaries between colors. And so Russian and English differ in that in English, there's the word blue, but in Russian, there isn't a single word that describes the whole range of colors that English call blue. There's instead a separate term for light blue, goluboy, and dark blue, sini. And so Russian speakers are forced by their language to distinguish light shades of blue from dark shades of blue because they have to call them by different names. And we asked whether that makes a difference in how easily Russian speakers are able to distinguish light and dark blues. And we found that there was actually a difference, that the practice of doing so in language, the fact that language forces you to make that distinction, actually makes Russian speakers faster to distinguish these shades of blue.
What you're talking about also is the way language evolves and its psychological mm-hmm. effects on us. It also gets us into some pretty central arguments about nature and nurture.
Of course, yeah. The question of whether language shapes thought is unfortunately positioned right at the center of some of the main controversies in cognitive science and about the nature of mind. To what extent is thinking universal? To what extent is it innate? And to what extent is it culturally based or socially based? Obviously, when you're studying differences and you're focusing on effects of experience, you're focusing very much on the side of culture and the side of nature in nurturing.
Where do you nurture this research of yours? Where do you see it going? It seems like it could go in so many directions.
For me, what's interesting is how we come to think the way we do and how we create the complex meanings that we do. Humans are incredibly smart, and the set of meanings and the knowledge systems that we have are exquisitely structured and complex. And I think language and culture and social interaction play an incredibly important part in helping us create these really complex meanings. So understanding the mechanisms through which we're able to invent notions like justice or time travel or imaginary numbers, that's what I've always been interested in. And so looking at the role that language plays in helping us build that knowledge is where I plan to continue going.
And what about looking back? I mean, instead of looking forward for the moment, because I think about English as an Indo-Aryan language and, say, Russian as a Slavic language, mm-hmm. and therefore one could say never the twain shall meet. Mm-hmm. I mean, just all that embedded history.
Languages certainly diversify very quickly. So English wasn't English 300 yeah. years ago, right? It was very, a very different language. You mentioned how languages change. Languages change by virtue of human contact and human inventiveness. And the very diversity of human languages is a real testament to how flexible and inventive the human mind is, that we're able to invent not just one way of looking at the world, but 7,000 and many more.
You also did some experiments on how language can help shape what we see. You use some color swatches. Talk about that.
We talked earlier about the work on Russian blues. So that's the that's the work on language and color. There, both in our work and work in other labs, what people are seeing is that language meddles in even pretty basic perceptual decisions. This was a surprise to us. We thought, well, you can decide whether two shades of blue are the same or not without language. Certainly, pigeons can decide whether two shades of blue are the same or not, and they don't speak any language. But it turns out that once you learn a linguistic distinction, it actually goes in and tries to meddle with everything that you're doing. And so that linguistic information becomes active very, very quickly and gets weighed in how you make your decisions.
We did a program a number of years ago on synesthesia, you know, where you experience language through color. Did you do any work with synesthesiacs?
You know, a couple of students of mine by accident ended up doing work on synesthesia. It was actually right as we were doing these experiments on language and color. And we had a participant come in, and she said she'd found the task really difficult because we were showing her colors and she had to at the same time recite some numbers. And she said, oh, the numbers were colored and the colors were colored. And I got them all confused. And we said, what do you mean the numbers were colored? The numbers were black. And turns out that she was synesthetic. And so these two students that interacted with her ended up working more on synesthesia. And they by accident discovered something very cool. There was for a long time a question of how people might get their synesthetic colors. So why might an A look red to you, whereas a B looks blue? And they found this one woman who claimed she got her colors from a set of refrigerator magnets that she had played with as a child that were colored letters. And they did not believe her because many claims like this existed before in the literature, but none had ever been proven. And she was very upset that they didn't believe her, and she went and found the Fisher-Price refrigerator magnets that her parents still had in the attic and brought them. And since then, it's turned out that there are lots of synesthetes have these Fisher-Price colors as their as their colors.
I didn't know if Fisher-Price could do that in their ad campaigns. In reading some of your work, I was looking at how Indonesian verbs never changed to express time. So, for example, if you kick a soccer ball, you kick a soccer ball.
So in Indonesian, whether you just kicked it or you're about to kick it or you're kicking it right now, the verb always stays the same, whereas, of course, in English, it has to change. And
I think that affected our president, who had to speak Indonesian, I guess, when he lived there?
You know what I think he got from Indonesia? He got his amazing smile. People in Indonesia have that
amazing, big, radiant smile. Yeah.
And
it's a good observation. And what about you also point out in your work that the Koreans are somehow better than English speakers at distinguishing, say, light as opposed to looser fittings?
Oh, yeah. So this is work that started with the work of Melissa Bowerman. Korean makes a distinction between tight fit and loose fit. So when in English you can say you can put a cassette into a sleeve or you can put an apple into a bowl. In both cases, the expression used is put into, but in one case it's a tight fit, in the other case it's a loose fit. English doesn't distinguish that.
You are listening to a conversation with Stanford psychologist Lyra Boroditsky. She joined Forum as part of our First Person series, profiling the innovative thinkers and notable characters who make our region unique. This is a special archive edition of Forum.